Hey, everybody, welcome to the podcast. And if you're new to the podcast, thanks for tuning in. Before we get to my guest this week, I just want to remind everybody I'm going to be on Broadway starting July 16th. Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio. It's a completely improvised show involving the audience, and it's going to be at the Jerry Orbach Theater, and it runs till August 15th. It's a limited run, July 16th to August 15th. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com, and you can click right there for tickets, and you get 40% off if you use the code TLS. This is a completely improvised show involving the audience, and there's some other cool parts. Really, really, really great set being built by the set designer who designed the set for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and The Daily Show. And I'm really psyched about this show, and I hope you could come out and support it. It'd be a big help and mean a lot to me. My guest this week, Alan Alda, great, great actor, star of one of the biggest hits in television history, MASH. Super excited to have him on. We talked about a whole bunch of different things. And after I talked to him, I'm like, you know, I haven't seen MASH in a long time. I'm going to go check out some episodes. And I tool around, and I can't see it on my cable system, so I do a search on my system. And this is what I got when I searched MASH. This is what came up. Vladimir Mashkov, I'm reading this off the screen, Tanisha K. Masha, Nelson Mashita, and Jeff MASH. Yeah, Jeff MASH. I loved his work as the attendant in the insulation department at Home Depot. They have all these MASHes, but they don't have MASH the series. So I went to deepdiscount.com. Great sponsor. They support me. Please support them. And they had a whole slew of episodes of MASH, as well as other great, great movies and TV shows that Alan Alda's been in. So I've watched the first two seasons of MASH, and they really hold up. There's a great movie called The Seduction of Joe Tynan with Alan Alda, which you should watch. It's really topical. It's just a really great political thriller. And he's a mad guy in Tower Heist, the movie with Ben Stiller and Eddie Murphy. Anyway, check out his stuff on deepdiscount.com. By the way, they got a great, great site-wide summer sale going on right now. So they got great, great prices on a lot of their inventory and products. And they don't just have classics from back in the day. They have hard-to-find titles, too. New releases out this week. Tyler Perry's Acrimony. It's a twist of a film along the lines of Fatal Attraction. And you get your copy now for a great price at deepdiscount.com. You know, I never had a Fatal Attraction. I wish somebody would fatally attract to me, if that's how it works. Anyway, go to my homepage, paulmercurio.com. Click on the deepdiscount.com link. Go right to their site and get great, great savings. Site-wide summer sale right now. Tens of thousands of items at super low prices. Again, go to my homepage, paulmercurio.com. Click on the deepdiscount.com link and go get some great deals. This is a very special edition of the podcast. I have a legend here, an iconic actor. I think he's going to go places if he sticks with it. the great Alan Alda, actor, director, screenwriter. You know him probably best as Hawkeye Pierce on MASH, but seven-time Emmy Award winner in movies and nominated for an Academy Award for his role in The Aviator. He's in Tower Heist, Tucker. He plays a very good bad guy and roles on ER, The West Wing, 30 Rock, and also his 11-year run with his PBS show, Scientific American Frontiers. And just a real pleasure and delight to have you today.
Thank you. What a nice thing.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. You can, if you don't want those, take them off.
It's up to
you.
No, it's nice. I like to hear myself.
Who doesn't, right? you have a new podcast coming out very soon called Clear and Vivid with Alan Alda, which focuses on conversations and stories from some of the world's most celebrated communicators. And I really love this idea and this topic. And I know this is the idea of communication, especially helping scientists communicate better, is near and dear to your heart because you have the Alda Center, which is based out of Stony Brook. But I want to jump right into the podcast and and what you're trying to do with it. And a quote that you made that really intrigued me. You said that effective science communication happens when we listen and connect. It happens when we use empathy. What do you mean by empathy in that context?
The way I use the word, the empathy is used in so many different ways.
Right.
A lot of people think it means that you have sympathy for somebody else, or mm-hmm. you care about them. The way I use it is, I think, a stricter way, which is that you are aware of what the other person is going through.
Oh, Okay.
And that means that I think that there's also dark empathy, not just nice empathy.
What is dark? Dark. You got some evil in you, Al.
You wonder why I play bad guys.
I just I got to jump off to the side for a minute. Man, you play such a good bad guy.
Well, once in a while, you get to play yourself.
I was saying to myself, this comes very naturally to this man. I think he's kind of a bad guy in real life.
All it is you just got to care. You got to want what the bad guy wants.
In Tower Heist, when they're walking you in, you're arrested and they're walking you in and you say, I'm going to have your badge by the end of the day or whatever. Yeah. I would have slapped you. I would have just given you a whack. You're really, really terrific.
Well, on the... I can't remember the name of the series where I string the guy up and torture him.
Oh.
Yeah.
ER?
No, they do that in real hospitals.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking about empathy.
Yes.
So the idea is the way I think it is essential to communication is to know what the person you're communicating with is going through so you know whether they're with you or not with you or you're the confused.
And that involves reading body language. In the face. Yep.
And if you're not even with them, if you're just writing for them or you're on the radio talking to them, mm-hmm. you can get an estimate in your head of what it's landing like on the other person.
And are you finding in this is 20 years or more of your focus on this, is that a common problem? Is listening and people just sort of maybe thinking about the next thing they want to say?
Yeah, that's what almost all of us do. It's what I do too. Mm. And I have to train myself out of it all the time because the tendency is to think good communication, my relating to you now is going to depend on my saying the right thing the right way.
Right.
But it's more than that. It's way more than that. Is it landing on you? Are you getting it the way I mean it?
Mm-hmm.
What good is a really well-formulated argument if it doesn't land?
I'm sorry. What did you say? I wasn't paying attention.
That's what I mean.
Come on, everybody. It's comedy.
I mentioned dark empathy.
Yes.
So dark empathy for me is when you know what the person is going through and you use it against them. Interrogators can do this.
Oh.
Salesmen can do it.
You're sensing a weakness in somebody.
You see what they need, what their soft spot is, and you go for it.
I had a woman named Sara Rangappa on the show recently. She was a FBI counterintelligence agent, and she's an analyst for CNN now. And that's exactly what she said in terms of turning an agent. Is you find their weaknesses.
So I ought to have her on my show.
You should.
Yeah.
No, you really should.
Yeah, it sounds.
She talks about how you turn an agent, being an agent yourself, and that was a big part of the conversation. And I'll give you her information after the show, but very much that, like find their weakness or find the need.
Yeah.
Even emotionally.
Right. So you got to be reading the person.
Yes.
But that's, she believes she's doing it for a good purpose. I guess everybody who uses somebody else thinks the purpose is good.
Right, exactly.
It's like, I need to make a living, so I'm going to suck you dry.
Exactly. Well, I was an investment banker, so I know what that's like.
Oh, right. but there you can use empathy to be of service to the other mm-hmm. person, which is, I think, the best way to handle an interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's say you're selling somebody something. You sell them this rattle trap that barely makes it off the lot.
Right.
Then that's the last time you'll see that customer.
Exactly.
You put them in a car they can afford that will last them a while.
Right.
They'll come back. They trust you.
Right.
It's better to have 10 old customers than 2 brand new ones.
Exactly.
Who spread bad word about you.
Yeah, exactly. And trust me, bad news travels fast.
It seems to,
especially,
doesn't it?
Do you find with the advent of social media and a society now, and this problem of not listening and not communicating effectively has become even worse?
Well, we're learning more and more that bad news and
fake news,
ugly news
yeah.
travels faster.
Yeah.
People want, they want a mud wrestling match rather than information
mm-hmm.
sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that when you look at an email or text message that you're writing and you think, I don't know if this person's going to think this is being snarky.
Yeah, exactly.
Or am I sincere?
Exactly.
That's when you stick an emoji in. And that, to me, is hope for the future, because that means you're thinking about the person who's going to read it.
Right.
So I don't think we're totally down the sinkhole yet.
The emoji is almost like if you and I are talking and we're good friends, and I say, as I preface some hard or bad news with, look, you're really great at what you do, but, so the emoji, that's like a verbal emoji, right? Like, I'm going to give you a little bad news, but then I'm going to give you a little smiley face around it or something that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My wife says whenever you hear but, that's when the real stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
The shotgun comes out.
Right. I always say that when a friend calls you haven't heard from in 10 years, it's the second thing on the call that they really called for. It's like, hey, Paul, how you doing? How's the family? Hey, you wouldn't have an extra kidney, would you? I need a kidney. And I'm using both of them. Listening, but also you talk a lot about improv and spontaneity. And in fact, you said film is a medium where spontaneity counts more than anything, but so many mechanical directions are thrown your way, it's almost impossible. Is that a big point of emphasis in your area of communication and training for people?
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, when we teach anybody communication skills, not just scientists and doctors, mm-hmm. but in corporations, we start with improvisation exercises. And these are not to make people comedians.
Right.
It's not comedy improv. It's exercises that put you in contact with the other person, where you are observing them. You have to observe them to play the game.
Is it a linchpin to listening? In other words, it forces listening because you have to be.
Yeah, in order to do the exercise, you have to listen.
Right, and so that's one way to get people to listen and sort of
And you get habituated, because the thing that I've found is you can't train people to be good communicators by giving them tips. You can't say here's 10 things to remember. Mm. It's an experience you have to go through.
You majored in science at Fordham.
Well, sort of. Mm. I should have come out of there with a BA, but in those days they wouldn't give you a Bachelor of Arts degree unless you knew Greek and Latin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I didn't have any background.
I had it down that you weren't paying attention or communicating well in class. No, I'm just kidding. I had to take Latin in high school.
I did too, but they wanted me to take it in college and
you said no.
Greek, and I wasn't that. I was interested in English.
Right.
I planned to write most of my stuff in English.
So not only one or two things in Latin or
just
Greek.
The occasional epigram. So they said you have to graduate with a degree in Bachelor of Science in Social Sciences.
Mm-hmm. But did you, I mean, you make this focus of communication, you focus it on scientists in particular. Obviously, you found that they, and doctors, had trouble communicating. What is their particular issue generally, if there is like an across the board issue?
Yeah, I don't think they have a greater trouble communicating than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It really is that I found out by interviewing a lot of scientists that
on the PBS show,
on the Scientific American mm-hmm. Frontiers, I found out that I could help them be better communicators and help them avoid some of the traps that we all fall into.
Mm-hmm.
We all talk a secret language if we know something in detail.
Right. It's true. I mean, I had Neil deGrasse Tyson on and we talked about black matter and we had to cover it very slowly for me.
Yeah, well, sure.
You know, and we got through it and it was great, but I understand. And he's a very good communicator. So he's also very animated and engaging. So
yeah.
I think that's part of it too, is do you work with people on just their physical or a presentation?
Well, the exercises, once you go through the exercises enough,
right,
the real you comes out. You're more personable. If you have a sense of humor,
more
it comes
animated.
Out more animated.
Right.
You're not stiff and defensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes a big difference. And we don't encourage people to get stuck behind the podium, but to come out and be vulnerable to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Stand out there without reading things, without reading your notes on the
prompter,
on the What do you call it?
Podium?
PowerPoint.
Oh, the PowerPoint. Yeah.
PowerPoint
yeah.
is a killer.
Yeah. Well, you get locked into that and you're not.
Well, some people turn their backs to the audience and read the PowerPoint.
Oh, Jesus. That's the first class.
Don't you can't even tell who's falling asleep.
I'm going to do the rest of this interview with my back to you and see how that goes. Well, you know, I do a stand up and I like to talk to the audience, and it really is all about listening. And I'll.
Yeah, tell me about that. That's really interesting.
Well, I just find it very awkward and weird to go on stage and immediately launch into a quote unquote an act.
Yeah.
I liken stand up.
So do you say who's from Toledo?
It's not, well, what you're from New Jersey? What exit?
what do you do first? How do you warm yourself up?
Before I go out?
No, when you're out there.
When I go out there, I just go out and I have no plan and I just start to talk to people about, I would see you and I would say, you look like you're smart, like you're a professor. You have, because I don't know why. That's the vibe I'm getting from you. And then you'll say yes or you'll say no. And then we'll go, whatever. You also look like you're in good shape. Do you walk? What do you eat?
Geez, you haven't got anything right so far.
How's your colon? Is your colon good? You got to check that every once in a while.
I had that operated on.
Oh, geez. Okay. Well, there you go. See?
So you're just like hitting nothing.
Well, what I'm doing is I want to just have real conversations with people and not worry about the laughs and trust that the laughs will come organically in the conversation.
Yeah. That's great. You make contact with them as people.
Yeah. It's not to insult them. It's really to have a conversation. So I'll tell you, I don't want to make this too much about me, but I'll tell you a very quick story. I was just in Minnesota a few days ago doing shows, and which was warmer than New York City, which is a whole other conversation. And people always say to me, well, these people, were they plants? They'll ask me after shows. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, well, and it all kind of worked out. How? I go, I don't know. I think it's just because I listen and respond. I don't think about what I'm going to say next. Mm-hmm. And it's also something I call is let the game come to me. It's almost like in basketball, they say, let the defense, see what the defense is giving you and work around it. I don't rush to get a punchline. Because if I rush to get a punchline in a conversation, it's going to be a surface cheap joke. But if we go deeper and deeper, then there'll be something. Yeah. Anyway, there was a woman, she's a lesbian. She came on stage and we talked. And
you bring them up from the audience.
Yeah, now I'm bringing them up from the audience.
Oh, great.
And she had a very short haircut, and she was wearing a plaid shirt, like a work flannel shirt. She looked like a lesbian, and she met her girlfriend at a softball game. So she made the joke about that. Everybody laughed. I brought her partner, wife, up. They met at a softball game. Her wife was married with three kids. They struck up a relationship. The wife divorced the husband with the three kids. And they all live in the same house together, the gay married couple, the ex-husband, and the three kids.
Oh, what an interesting story.
And it was very sweet. And they had such a good time, they came back the next night and they brought their three kids.
Oh, that's great.
So now something to me more special happened in that situation than, and then of course I told jokes and we had a lot of laughs during the course of the night. But I do, this, all of what you're talking about really strikes home to me because sort of, in the trenches doing it, I find the same thing.
You're doing it. You're really doing it. And look how much gold there is in that. And the contact alone.
In the same show, there was a gay porn star with his mother there.
With his mother?
27-year-old gay porn star was sitting right down front. And his mother couldn't have been prouder. And we talked about it. And I didn't make fun of him. I'm like, you know, I get it. You know, if that's what you want to do, because he likes the money. And so I feel like...
Was his mother wearing like a tiara?
His mother was dressed very scantily clad.
Tassels.
Right, exactly. Just tassels, like from the burlesque days, with like a big headdress and doing...
But that is an interesting arrangement.
I mean, that's in one show.
Did you find out if she had to make an adjustment or...
The mother?
Yeah.
To him?
To his line of work. Not to his sexuality, but his line of work.
Well, I mean, you know, we talked about it a little bit, and then I'm like, well, okay, well, this is what this guy does, and he's happy about it. And then I said to him, if I were gay, would you hit on me? He goes, no. I go, why? He goes, because you don't look like you have a lot of money. He was so funny. And he meant it. It was all about the money. Now, you know, it's working out for him. But I think this thing of idea of communication, especially now with... People want to communicate through texting and emails and not conversation. It's never been more important what you're trying to do with this. And the podcast, you're going to be having communicators, great communicators that are really well known.
And people, one of the points I want to make is that this is for everybody. So I'd like to talk to people who communicate about things in ways you don't expect. For instance, I did an interview with a woman who wrote a book about how she has stage 4 cancer and what it's like to handle the people who are friends of hers who don't know what to say to her. So there's the communication with sick people in your life.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the communication between mothers and daughters and fathers.
Yeah.
Lovers.
Employer, employee.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And doctors and patients, that's a big subject. Mm-hmm. I think I'll, you know, do that more than once because it's so important to all of us and so many aspects to it. But with the woman, Kate Bowler, with the stage 4 cancer, actually has had people say to her, well, you know, the reason this is happening is God needs more angels.
Okay.
But how do they know?
Exactly.
And why can't God make his own angels?
Exactly. What if they're wrong? What if she's, hey, am I supposed to be going up? Why am I going down? No, I'm supposed to be on that up escalator. You talked about self-improvement and you wrote in something called 3 Minutes, My Unfortunate Disease of Self-Improvement. I'm condemned by some inner compulsion to think about the daily rituals of my life. I have a low grade level of improving myself in many ways. And you talk about making oatmeal.
Yeah. Right.
Is this effort to kind of help the world and people communicate better an extension of your own sort of tendencies for self-improvement? And where did this whole...
It might be. I don't know. I remember when I wrote that little essay, I was thinking about making oatmeal. It took me 3 minutes to make the oatmeal.
Right.
And I thought, is this 3 minutes out of my life? Am I just standing here waiting for oatmeal to cook? This doesn't seem right. I should be getting something out of this.
You should be doing something. So I'm not advancing myself as a
human being. No, I wasn't a better person at the end of 3 minutes. I had oatmeal, but that's about it.
What if you had to make the steel oats, the one that you got to stir for like 45
minutes?
Actually,
that's what it was. I would make that's how much I was onto myself and how I was into self-improvement.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the week, I'd make a huge vat of steel-cut oatmeal, which would take a half an hour, 40 minutes.
Right.
Then I'd store it, and every day I'd chop off some and chop it up and put it in the zapper.
Oh. So
that's where the 3 minutes came in.
You really would have made something of yourself, Alan, if you had just used that 3 minutes more wisely.
You know, when I was a kid in college, my friends all said, the smart friends said, you know what a genius is? A genius is somebody who knows how to use 5 minutes. And here I can't even use 3 minutes. So I'm screwed.
You're screwed. You're a failure. Your ability to communicate, which I would imagine is very good. You're obviously very engaging. And everything that I watched of you, you know, in some interviews and stuff and getting ready for this conversation, just so engaging. Did that get honed over time as an actor and director and tell the Anwar story, if you don't mind, which I absolutely love.
Yeah. Have you acted in movies?
Yeah, I have.
So you know what the demands are.
Yeah, yeah.
So there were two questions there. One was, how did I get so great?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, and how does your role as a great actor all these years, I would imagine, fed the communication skill and vice versa?
Right. In this way, I studied improv. It's the only thing I ever studied about acting.
Right, because you said you didn't want to study acting because it would ruin sort of the gift that you felt you had.
I thought I had this great gift.
You do.
And I was very talented, but I didn't hone the talent.
6 months. You were 6 months when your father had you out there on the stage, right?
Well, yeah. And I did have some inner talent. But if you don't develop the talent, all you got is talent. And
right. You
can't handle a lot of things.
Right.
But I did study improv.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's the best preparation for acting, yeah. I think. But then you asked me this other question. Oh, the armoire story.
Yeah. Well, hang on the improv thing, it's the best preparation because it forces you to be in the moment and listen and react. And that is the reason.
Yeah. And you can't have, it's like communication. Communication is not just thinking up a good message and spraying it at the person you're talking to.
Right.
And by the same token, a good performance isn't figuring it out the night before and then coming in and doing it at the other person. My performance comes out of the eyes of the other person. That's where I find it. I'm relating to them.
When there are lines that you have to say.
I have to say the same lines every night, but they can come out 100 different ways.
And that would happen when you would do different takes on MASH as well?
Sure. And by the way, it's not a question of saying, now I'm going to do it this way, now I'm going to do it that way. It's letting it change because of what I'm getting from you.
Second to second, you're different than you were that second before.
So your face is changing every millisecond.
I hope it's getting more handsome, but go ahead.
No, I find you very attractive.
Thank you. Can we have some time alone, guys, please?
Your face is changing my tone of voice.
Right.
And what I say next and that kind of thing. And that's what happens in a good performance where both people are tuned into this. Mm-hmm. Is that my phone that went off?
I don't know what that
Maybe is. It's my agent. Hello. No, I'm doing this for free. Don't bother me.
Wait, I think you're going to get residuals for that thing you did.
Oh, no, this
is
Words with Friends.
Oh, you do that?
Yeah.
Is it fun?
I love it.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's nice.
It's a key. Keeps you in touch with people that you might not otherwise.
Yeah, if you spend like 3 minutes with somebody who's now asleep in California, what do you think of them?
Exactly. At least you're thinking of them. But that moment-to-moment change in you allows you to most naturally deliver those lines differently than you did 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah, and it's the difference between invention and discovery. I'm not inventing a new way to say the line. I'm discovering it's coming out of me differently. Almost completely automatically, because I'm responding to you. I've lent myself to you.
But you're also in a relationship with a director who wants that performance the way that they see it, which is, you know, so if you're sort of doing a line differently than, not, I'm not saying you're off script and you're not doing the line at all. You're doing the line, but sort of delivering it as a slightly different person. How do you then work with the director if you want to be so in the moment and be true to what you want to do, but also be true to what he or she may want?
But there are all kinds of limits on what you do. The way the scene is written, what the author wants, what the director, how the director sees it. Mm. And then there are all these other mechanical limits. You have to be on your mark. Mm. There's a little piece of tape on the floor, and if you don't stand right there, you're out of the light.
Right.
Or you're out of focus.
Or you have to rush because you're going to lose some natural light that you
might.
Right,
right. So there are a lot of artificial limits or mechanical limits. Mm-hmm. But even with all those limits, there's still going to be a lot of variation in what happens between two actors.
Right.
And you'll still stay within. I mean, when a director directs a play that I'm in, I'm still following the director's directions. Mm-hmm. After 6 months, but in those 6 months, we will have done the play many different ways.
Right.
Still within those limits. So Wayne Rogers and I were in MASH together. And when we would shoot out at the location, which was about 45 minutes away, I would drive and he would be in the passenger seat because he didn't like to drive.
Oh, okay.
So we'd spend it. We were really good friends and we'd spend this 45 minutes interpreting each other's dreams.
That's great.
So I said, Wayne, I had this dream last night. You and I were in a scene together, and the director said, just for the camera, the way the camera's shooting this, say this next line from the top of the armoire. climb up to the top of the armoire and say the line. And I told Wayne this dream, and he said, this is a very important dream.
And he's being serious?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he was, and he was right. He said, this was early on in the series. Mm. And he said, as we do this show, directors are going to ask us to do all kinds of artificial things that are not believable, not truthful. Mm. We have to be careful never to do an armoire. And for the next several years, we'd be rehearsing a scene and the director would say, would you mind just faking this move here a little bit? And we'd say, don't do an armoire.
You had your own code between you?
Yeah.
That's so great. And is it true that you had written in your contract for MASH that at least once in an episode there had to be a scene in the operating room?
No. That's one of several internet myths.
Okay.
Yeah. What I did do before I agreed to do the show was to make sure that the producers agreed that it was not a show about hijinks at the front.
Right.
That we would take the experience seriously.
Right.
The experience of war, people getting shot up and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always intended that there would be operating scenes in all the shows.
Yeah, and it does lend a tremendous amount of realism to the whole thing, obviously, and sort of...
And that's what it's about.
That to me, was always the core of the show.
And, and in real life, people didn't always survive those operations.
Right.
But the network, first of all, wanted it... They didn't even want to show blood in the operating room.
Really?
Yeah. In the pilot, we shot the operating room scene with a red light. So everything looked a little red, and you couldn't tell what was blood and what wasn't.
Oh, wow.
And as soon as we got on the air, we took the red light out.
Right.
But they didn't, the first time somebody died on the operating table, the head of the network went nuts. And he said, "What is this, a situation tragedy?"
That's a good line.
It's pretty good.
That's a good line. And how did you were successful? I mean, I don't know if a MASH or an All in the Family could even get on TV today. I mean,
it would be on one of the streaming,
right?
Places.
Yeah, Netflix or something. Yeah. How were you able to convince them? The more in success, the more power you had to say, "No, we want to do it this way."
Yeah, the more successful you got. I'll tell you. Here's an example. When we were in one of our last seasons, we had a show where a North Korean soldier was going to take a young woman away and who we had treated, and he was going to execute her.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him a son of a bitch. And everybody on the set says, "Well, you got to do an alternate shot. You can't say that. They're not going to let us." I said, "Let them censor us. Let's not censor ourselves."
Right.
This is what you would say to somebody who's going to shoot this young woman.
Yeah, a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. Nobody complained. That went on the air. Now you roll the time back to one of our first, I think it was our first season.
Mm-hmm.
Radar says, somebody says, "Are you going to do that?" Whatever. I don't know what it was. Mm. And he says, "No, I don't know about that. I'm a virgin at that, sir." Meaning nothing sexual. Just, "I've never done that before." Not allowed to say the word virgin.
What?
Yeah. So Larry Gelbart, who wrote the show, in the next episode, had this exchange between me and a soldier. He's coming by on a stretcher. I say, "Where are you from, son?" He says, "The Virgin Islands, sir."
That's so great.
And they couldn't do anything about it.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's funny you mentioned that because there's a show called Schitt's Creek with Eugene Levy.
Right.
It's S-C-H-I-T-Z. It's the Schitt's family. Dude, he was on The Late Show with Colbert, and they would not let them say Schitt's Creek without bleeping Schitt's.
That's amazing.
And so what they did was every time they said Schitt's, the logo for the show would come up over one of their mouths. They said,
that's good.
So it'd be like, "Shit," and then they silence the shits and it would come up. And you could just go, "Really? That's..."
So how do you feel about that? I mean, you're a comic and you're free to use all kinds of language. Do you use coarse language or do you avoid it? Or what?
I don't actively do it. I feel like it's kind of a crutch, but I might swear. Look, I'm Italian and I have a temper and I do think stereotypes apply. So I might swear here and there, but that's about it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's a big deal because, I mean, I feel like there are a lot of things that people hear and say that are much, much worse. But I'll only do it, usually if I get really emotional about something, I might let a word fly. But generally, I like to try to keep it clean because it's a little bit more of a challenge.
Yeah, it's like the limit that you have to you have to work within, like writing a song lyric.
It's really
those
exactly
32 notes.
And the dynamic with the live audience is fascinating to me. The psychology of it, I could talk all day because the audience has all the power, but you can't let them know that because they'll eat you alive. I mean, it's like a girl that you really want. And if you try too hard, right? I mean, I know you've been married 61 years and you got married in 57. Was it true that it was like a cake fell on the floor or something and you both ate it off the floor?
Right.
Tell them that story.
Well, you just told it.
All right, there you go. I thought there was more. It's such a cute story. It's great. You were at a party.
We were at a dinner party, and we had only met once, but I was too shy to say anything. She was playing chamber music, and I was so shy, all I could say was, oh, you were very good. So the next time we met, we were at a dinner table, and she was laughing at my jokes, and I was really interested in her.
Oh, really?
And the hostess had made a rum cake and put it to cool on top of a refrigerator that was old and shook while it worked. And the cake made its way to the edge of the top of the refrigerator and fell on the floor. We all heard it go plop. Mm. And Arlene and I were the only two people who went inside with spoons and ate it off the floor. So the thing is, flirting over food is the ultimate.
It's a great thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the audience is like that. And if you give them the power.
Well, what do they do if you give them the power?
They start to, they won't respond in the way you think that they should respond. Or I'll give you an example. Somebody just yelled something out. I was talking to a couple and they were married and the guy was answering all the questions. And then I said, how long have you been married? And the woman went, 25 years. And the way she said it, it was just kind of funny. And everybody laughed. This is a live stand-up show.
Yeah.
So we're moving on. And then a woman, like a 30-year-old woman, to my right says, what, a woman can't speak in public? And I'm like, what? She goes, wait, what? Why are you all laughing why only the man can answer all the questions? I go, you're joking, right? And the crowd now at this point goes, ah, oh, come on. So now I know the crowd is thinking the same thing I'm thinking, like you're reading into this, right?
Yeah.
And she goes, no. I go, oh, I see what this is. I said, you're going to go through that door there and you're going to sit at the bar and you're going to watch me through the window. I'm going to be up here for 15 minutes. I said, when I'm done, you're going to see me walk off and you can come back in. Or you can sit there and keep your mouth shut and not do anything like that again, because this isn't about you. You need a march or you need a petition and you can go deal with your issues outside of this room. Or I said, you can go work hell gigs for 10 years and earn the right to be on the stage. But if you think that this is going to happen, it's not. She stayed in the room.
Was the audience with you then?
They applauded.
Huh.
So that cannot happen.
Boy, that sounds like you turning on the audience.
No. Because if you let that happen, no, we had a great time. And in fact, again, I don't want to make this torture about me, but if I let that go, she would have the power. And then she, first of all, she wouldn't laugh at any of my jokes. And she would have the power and probably try to derail in other ways. And she also needs to be told you don't do that in shows, you know? Go write it on social media, but you don't.
Do you find people more interested, more free to speak up now than they were before?
No. In some ways, there's a lot of political correctness that's bled into stand-up. You know, in the days of Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce, you know, those were, and George Carlin, when he went from AM to FM, and they, you know, they could speak truth to power, but it's a little tricky now. Like that
for the comics. I'm talking about the audience.
Oh. You mean in terms
does the audience heckle more?
No, I don't think so. I think that really depends on the act. And if they sense a weak act, then they might, you know. But generally, no, that's not the problem. The irony is colleges, which used to be the place where was the counterculture, where you could go and speak about real issues, has become so regimented in what you can say. They literally make you sign contracts that said you won't make references to drugs or to sex or... So it's a different.
That's several people's whole act.
Exactly. It's like, hey, you put me out of business, pal.
I'll just read this document.
Exactly. let me just read. Like Lenny Bruce was reading his court as his appeal document.
That's right.
Remember that?
Yeah, that was funny.
he just turned it into a whole thing, and he literally read court papers on stage, and people stayed. Like,
I know.
Crazy.
I saw some film of that. It wasn't much of an act.
No, I know. Did you ever meet Carlin, or did you know?
No,
him?
I never. Did.
Yeah. I know radio had a big impact on you, and you talk about, I think you were 10 and you were listening to Steve Allen on the radio.
It's one of his, I think it was his first show on KFI in Los Angeles.
And you said it was so clear to you that it was improvisation and he was going off the
top. Sure, he'd go out into the, he was the first guy that I know of who went out into the audience and improvised with the audience. And they'd say something. It's what you talk about at the beginning of your act.
Yeah.
They'd say something simple and he'd answer it, and pretty soon it's funny.
And do you feel like that sort of was the maybe one of the moments where sort of this idea of spontaneity just became
important
to you? It might
have been. But also every week, every Sunday night, my father's old friends from burlesque, the comics and strippers, would come over to the house, mm-hmm. and we'd lay on the rug in the living room and shoot craps. I'm 10 years old shooting craps with
that's so awesome.
With these strippers who I know as friends of the family, you know. And then the comics would let me take part in the sketches. They would do sketches for one another. They loved performing for one another.
In the living room,
yeah.
Ones that were already honed just to do it?
Yeah, everybody knew all the sketches. Uh-huh. The sketches were all public domain. If Handful of Nickels, The Crazy House.
Oh.
Flugel Street.
What was the one with the pig? There was a thing with a pig?
Well, that was a sketch my father wrote with his partner, Hank Henry. And they had a bit at the end of the, excuse me, I've got morning sludge.
Oh, I never heard it referred to as morning sludge.
Yeah, well, later I get afternoon sludge.
It's a different kind of sludge.
Yes.
Different texture.
So they wrote this sketch, and at the end of this, somewhere in the middle of the sketch, Hank Henry says to my father, "Get out of here and don't come back until you can bring home the bacon." So at the end of the sketch, my father comes in with a live pig under his arm and says, "Well, I brought home the bacon." Blackout. This was actually got a laugh in those days. Yeah. I don't know why.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe the sight of the pig. But they were traveling around the Eastern Circuit, mm-hmm. In a car. So there was room in the car for my father, my mother, Hank Henry, and the pig.
What about you?
They left me with my crazy aunt in Wilmington, Delaware.
Oh, so I hated
that pig. I really hated the pig.
You, to me, you have more value than a pig. I think you bring more to the table.
Well, thank you.
How was that? Was there any question that you were going to go into show business? I know, you were 16 when you did Summer Stock, right?
Yeah, I very much wanted. I wanted to be a writer first and then an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And my father wanted me to be a doctor because I think he had always wanted to be a doctor.
And he probably was worried about the security of this business.
Yeah, and he knew it was a very tough business. And he had a hard time in the business, you know. It was not easy for him. But by the time I was 16, I hadn't seen any hard times from him. I'd only seen good times.
Oh, because he had, you know. Yeah.
I thought it was automatic.
Yeah, it's a slam dunk. It looks easy for my dad. It's going to be easy for me.
Yeah.
And why were you leaning toward writing at the time? Did you feel, was that where your passion was? Or
I just loved it. I loved making things up, writing them down.
Science, huh?
No, well, I was.
Because it seems like with your background and in your focus now, in the back of your mind, was science ever a career that you thought of?
No, not a career, but I was always interested in it. I was an amateur inventor as a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd make models of things. I made my own malted milk machine.
Really?
Yeah.
So, completely from the ground up?
Yeah, it worked.
Really?
Yeah. And I invented this thing, a refrigerator with a Lazy Susan in it, so you wouldn't have to reach to the back.
Oh my God, that's brilliant.
It's smart, isn't it?
I have this, my wife puts all the stuff that I use all the time in the back, and then there's like maraschino cherries right up front that we never use.
Well, this was such a good idea that there was a refrigerator company a year or two after I got this idea that put one out. And they put out a refrigerator with a Lazy Susan.
There would have been a line of Alan Alda refrigerators.
Yeah, it must not have worked because they stopped manufacturing them. I think there were jars of ketchup flying around kitchens. If you spin it too fast, you get mustard all over.
There's a lawsuit.
Yeah, right.
The defective Lazy Susan. I got hit in the head.
But I was always interested in science, and the reason I wanted to do the science show is I thought I could interview them and spend the day with them and learn about what they do.
Did you feel there was a void then, like that there wasn't sort of a good place that people could go to really understand science?
No, I just wanted to learn. I just wanted to have fun.
And I think if people see you having fun, they have fun.
And they saw me understand it for the first time.
Right.
And it was a little television moment. And they would be in a better position to understand it themselves, because it would be edited so that you could lead right up to that flash of understanding.
Right.
That's one of the things that made it work.
And do you feel like there's, I mean, with all the outlets now, we were mentioning streaming and never a better time to be able to communicate with people with all the social media. But unfortunately, it's being used in a negative way with this, you know, fake news and manipulation with the Russians and all of that. Do you incorporate any of those ideas into the programs, the communication program at the Alda Center? Or?
No, I don't think we deal. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. I'll take some of that sludge. That'll be worth something someday.
Yeah.
Put it in a cup. That's Alan Alda's sludge. What? It's Alan Alda's sludge, okay? No one else has it.
Jeez, I'm getting disgusted.
He's an inventor of the Lazy Susan for the refrigerator, my God.
So what was this last question? I can't remember.
Oh, it was a...
fake news. No,
The social media aspect of communication.
We don't deal directly with fake news.
Mm-hmm.
What we deal with is how to communicate real news.
No, I know that. But I mean, I meant like in terms of the importance of social media now, which is obviously a big part of how do we communicate. That is that sort of, that's obviously part of, you know, our life now.
But, you know, something can be learned from how fake news travels, because there was an interesting article in the paper about a kid who was 12 years old who did a very engaging video for YouTube demonstrating that there was no evidence for getting autism from vaccines.
Hmm.
But it was a snarky demonstration that he did, and it went viral. And sorry. He felt bad that he had been snotty. So he did a more reserved version of a science presentation, and nobody watched. Or very few. So the conclusion that he drew is that people want to see turmoil. They want to see conflict. They want to see insult.
Yeah.
That's why I said before, it's like a mud wrestling match.
Well, it's definitely become a meaner society. Like if I go on some of these talk shows, the cable news shows as a commentator, satirist, whatever, and if I go on Fox News and I say anything that's the least bit liberal, I get lambasted on Twitter by these people. They just come at me. And no holds barred. And it's really unsettling. Like my wife's like, just don't even look at it anymore.
Yeah, you got to not look at
it. And I don't, because, you know, you did this one thing before we wrap up. You would read the Congressional Record.
Yeah, I did. I loved it.
It's so funny.
I was 10 years old.
You were 10.
Yeah. Oh, and the living room in our house apparently had been decorated by somebody who bought books by the yard. And these books all were leather bound. So they look nice on the bookshelf. So I see these books up there, and I think they look really pretty, red leather bindings. Yeah. I think, what's in them? That must be interesting. What is that?
Right.
So I laid down on the floor and opened up the book, and it's dialogue. It reads like a play.
Oh, it's actually, it's like a transcript.
Yeah, it's a transcript. So this is like a real life play.
Yeah.
Well, the esteemed senator from Illinois relinquish his time. So And they, little by little, I see they're insulting each other in very polite terms.
Oh, very subtle, passive-aggressive kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I loved it. I didn't understand what they were talking about most of the time, but I loved reading it.
But you played a senator in The Aviator. You were doing research at 10 for that role.
Yeah, right.
You didn't even know.
Right.
And then in terms of MASH, did that part, was that, I mean, obviously it was based on the movie, but did they come to you and say, you're our guy? Did you have to... I mean, you're an established actor, you'd have to read for it. Like, how did that come about that you were?
Well, they knew my work from the stage and from some movies I had done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the Utah State Prison when they sent me the script.
What?
It wasn't for acting. I was actually making a movie there for 3 weeks.
Oh.
And that was a really strange experience. They made me a hostage at one point.
Oh, wow.
For real.
Really?
Well, they said they were kidding, but they had a knife to my throat.
This feels really real to me right
now. Yeah. It's not cold. It's not that funny. So, but it was a wonderful script, but I didn't think I could do it because I lived in on the East Coast. And I said to my wife, this might run a whole year. So she said, look, if it's that good, maybe we can deal with it by travel.
Yeah.
So the family stayed in New Jersey and I went back and forth.
Every weekend?
Yeah, every weekend for about 4 months out of the year for a few years until the kids were in college.
It's incredible. God, yeah, that's...
Well, it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
I would fly all night. I'd get to New York. Arlene would meet me at the airport about 6 in the morning, and we'd have an hour drive to New Jersey where we'd get together and talk. Right. And then I'd go to sleep and wake up at noon, and the kids would say, see ya.
So you get to see them, or can I have $10 and see
you? Right.
Did once you started doing the role, did you feel like you could do that role? I mean, you're so good in it, but I mean, was it work to kind of get that character in your way?
I didn't think I could be the guy. He didn't seem anything like me.
Why? Because he was too.
He was a skirt chaser. He drank too much. Right. He was a smart aleck.
But he had a truthful core, and truth seems to be the other thing that comes out in reading about you. Sort of, truth is a very important thing to you, and there was a truthful, honest core to that character, I thought.
Yeah, but no matter how much I analyze the character and find correspondences, I still have to somehow feel comfortable. I have to be in the guy's shoes.
Yeah.
Some actors do that by actually wearing the shoes of the character.
Right.
And then there was a story I was told by an old actor once about a play that was rehearsing across the street from the Lambs Club.
Mm-hmm.
And the actor playing Lincoln in the play came in wearing Lincoln shoes the first day to the Lambs Club for lunch. And these two ancient actors watch him come in. The next day he comes in with the pants, then the coat with tails. And finally he comes in with a tall hat.
No, yeah. God, I was wondering.
And the one actor says to the other, that young man won't be satisfied until he's assassinated.
That's great. Oh, God, this is fantastic. I could talk to you all day. The podcast is coming out very shortly. And is it going to be once a week?
We'll put out a whole bunch of them in case anybody wants to binge.
Okay.
And it's so nice of you to talk about it. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I want to look up that person you talked about because since it deals with every kind of communication, how you turn somebody into a spy for you is really interesting, and that takes real communication.
Yeah, and it's a process over time. Like it's sort of, so you have to slowly, you know, it's almost like dating, and then you know, wooing a woman to marry her maybe. But like, she said, you know, it's not something that happens overnight, and you have to have patience as the person doing it to understand that eventually it may not even come to pass that you can turn the person, but you have to be fully invested in it every step of the way, which is so key to good communication.
Yeah, right. You got to really be connected to the other person. Well, I'm going to listen to your podcast interviewing her, so I'll know what questions to ask.
Yeah, exactly. And she's got a great Lazy Susan story as well. The podcast is Clear and Vivid with Alan Alda, and it debuts July 10th. And these are going to be conversations with some of the most celebrated communicators. And I can't tell you what a treat this is.
This is great fun. And, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you for having me.
And I never thought I'd get to say Alan Alda's sludge. But if you live long enough, dreams happen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has really been a special treat.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. And I hope you all enjoyed it. And we'll see you next week, folks. All right. That was Alan Alda. How great is he? I could have talked to him all day. What a history and show business, and really psyched to have him on. Hope you enjoyed it. And please check out my one-man show on Broadway starting July 16th, running to August 15th. Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio. Tell your friends about it. Bring your friends. You're going to get a 40% discount. go to my website, paulmercurio.com, click on the link there, and just use the code TLS. That's TLS. Hope to see you on Broadway, July 16th. See you next week, everybody.